Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
Okay, it's your turn. Tell us about your story.
I selected William Faulkner's story, Barn Burning.
Had you read it before?
I had not read this one before. No, actually, because of our conversation for the last episode about the John Updike story, separating, we talked a lot about voice. So I was thinking about voice after that recording, and I was like, I want to look at another story that has like a really rich voice. And it made me think of Faulkner because I'd read Sound and the Fury, which is like about, it has four different sections and they're each written in a different like style slash voice. Like they have four different characters and they're
Right.
totally different. Like one's first person, one's third person, different like short sentences, long sentences, just they're so different. And then I've also read Absalom Absalom by him, which is one of those books that like the stereotypical Faulkner super long sentence style. And in that story, he was trying to do something specific with like memory, you know, where what's present and what's memory kind of fade together.
Right.
And so just thinking about Faulkner, I was like, I want to bring a good Faulkner story that has a good voice to it. And I just looking around, I was like, this one seemed like, and I read a couple of paragraphs and I was like, yeah, I think this is the kind of story that has that voice. It doesn't have the same voice as I was thinking of for Absalom Absalom, but it has that a kind of stream of consciousness kind of style to it in third person.
Yeah, so let's read a section before we get too far along in that.
Get that boy up here, he knows. For a moment, the boy thought too that the man meant his older brother, until Harris said, not him, the little one, the boy, and crouching, small for his age, small and wiry like his father, in patched and faded jeans, even too small for him, with straight, uncombed brown hair and eyes gray and wild as storm scud, he saw the men between himself and the table part and become a lane of grim faces, at the end of which he saw the justice, a shabby, collarless, graying man in spectacles, beckoning him. He felt no floor under his bare feet. He seemed to walk beneath the palpable weight of the grim turning faces. His father, stiff in his black Sunday coat, donned not for the trial, but for the moving, did not even look at him. He aims for me to lie, he thought, again with that frantic grief and despair, and I will have to do it. What's your name, boy? The justice said. Colonel Sartorius Snopes, the boy whispered. Hey? The justice said. Talk louder. Colonel Sartorius? I reckon anybody named for Colonel Sartorius in this country can't help but tell the truth, can they? The boy said nothing. Enemy, enemy, he thought. For a moment he could not see that the justice's face was kindly, nor discern that his voice was troubled when he spoke to the man named Harris. Do you want me to question this boy? But he could hear, and during those subsequent long seconds, while there was absolutely no sound in the crowded little room, save that of quiet and intent breathing, it was as if he had swung outward at the end of a grapevine over a ravine, and at the top of the swing had been caught in a prolonged instant of mesmerized gravity, weightless in time. No, Harris said violently, explosively. Damnation, send him out of here. Now time, the fluid world, rushed beneath him again, the voices coming to him again through the smell of cheese and sealed meat, the fear and despair and the old grief of blood. This case is closed. I can't find against you, Snopes, but I can give you advice. Leave this country and don't come back to it. His father spoke for the first time, his voice cold and harsh, level, without emphasis. I aim to. I don't figure to stay in a country among people who, he said something unprintable and vile, addressed to no one. That'll do, the justice said. Take your wagon and get out of this country before dark. Case dismissed. His father turned, and he followed the stiff black coat, the wiry figure walking a little stiffly from where a Confederate provost's man's musket ball had taken him in the heel on a stolen horse 30 years ago, followed the two backs now, since his older brother had appeared from somewhere in the crowd, no taller than the father but thicker, chewing tobacco steadily, between the two lines of grim-faced men and out of the store and across the worn gallery and down the sagging steps and among the dogs and half-grown boys in the mild May dust, where, as he passed, a voice hissed, Barn burner! Again, he could not see, whirling. There was a face in a red haze, moonlike, bigger than the full moon, the owner of it half again his size, he leaping in the red haze toward the face, feeling no blow, feeling no shock when his head struck the earth, scrabbling up and leaping again, feeling no blow this time either, and tasting no blood, scrabbling up to see the other boy in full flight and himself already leaping into pursuit as his father's hand jerked him back, the harsh, cold voice speaking above him, Go get in the wagon. Reading those out loud and realizing I'm not reading them in a southern accent feels so wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's part of the voice. You kind of know that that's coming across when you read it. Maybe it sounds a little more literary, but I totally get what you mean when you're talking about the stream of consciousness. But I like the part, this paragraph that's the full paragraph of narrative, you know, it says his father turned and he followed the stiff black coat.
Oh, yeah.
Between the dialogue, it's easier to kind of see how the story then gets into the flow, because at the beginning here, especially, there's a lot of dialogue.
Yeah.
And so there's moments when you get into that flow of the prose, but that's when you can really, it feels like it's singing, like it's opening up, you know? Because sometimes, like, the stream of consciousness can be hard to get into, can be hard to read. When I started this story, it was, I think, right after I had glanced at the one that I chose for the week. And so anytime I'm switching between any kind of writing or reading, it can be difficult, but this one especially I think is hard to kind of like get your bearings at first. And that first paragraph is similar to the one that I just pointed out, where it's sweeping and it's opening up and you're like, okay, so this is what we're dealing with here.
Yeah.
But once you're in it, you can almost see like how you would mimic it, you know? I don't know about you, but when I watch a TV show and they have accents or they talk in a certain way, or it's like a period TV show, like afterwards I'm talking like these characters and I'm joking around and doing it, but you just like absorb it, you know? And this feels like the kind of story where if you read it before you started writing something, you would probably naturally fall into this kind of like sweeping way of talking about things. And we talked about it being stream of consciousness, but it feels better than that. I feel like when we say stream of consciousness, we're almost telling people like, just go for it. Don't think about it. This is obviously well thought out. Like every word and every sentence, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Some people think like unfiltered. This is not unfiltered.
Yeah. There's a difference between well-crafted stream of consciousness and automatic writing or just spilling out onto the page, you know. One is a well-crafted kind of experience, and the other is just like a pouring forth. It won't work in the end. You can put it out there, but then you have to craft it. You have to like shave the corners off and like polish it.
Yeah. Or you could do something like what I suggested, and I think it works. Like I find that when I read something, and it might be a book that I've been reading for weeks, if I were to go write something almost immediately afterwards, like I can turn off a part of my brain and do a lot of the heavy lifting of that tone. And yes, you still have to go in and do what you said, like shaving the corners off and, you know, doing the editing, but there's something that just naturally gets you into that. It's like when someone sets a pitch for you and then you can sing along with them or something. You just need that starting point and then you're there.
Yeah. And that can be true for not only this kind of like long-winded kind of flowy stuff, also any style. Yeah. And talking about the flow, I wanted to mention the first time I read Absalom Absalom, and this was years ago. I barely remember these books. Long time ago I read them, but I do remember the experience of reading the first chapter of Absalom Absalom. I was on a treadmill and I had the book and I was reading it and it felt like jumping into a river. The prose just carried me. It was like this excitement, this kind of just like momentum to it. It might have had to do with the fact that I was on a treadmill. I was just walking. I wasn't running or anything.
Okay,
But by the time I got to the end of the chapter, it really felt like it pulled me through something. It felt like jumping into a river.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about this before where someone describes a book as being a page turner. And one of the ways that you can achieve that feeling is by having short chapters. Yeah. I think the same can be said about having long sentences.
Yes.
There's something about it that you cannot finish that paragraph. You can't stop in the middle of it. You have to finish it. Like very rarely are we like getting bored in the middle of a sentence when we read a book. It's more like you see this paragraph and it's daunting and you don't really feel like getting into the next section of whatever and you're just bored and also bad writing. But yeah, I mean, there's a magic element to this too, where it does carry you along.
Yeah. And with Faulkner, it's not just in the middle of a paragraph. It's in the middle of a sentence. He can't stop. It's like, all right, well, I'll stop after this sentence and then you finish the chapter.
We've talked about the style of this writing, but I think the sections where it's showing are really strong. And I like this one. It's at the top of page 15. I'm pretty sure this is one sentence, but it looks like a solid paragraph. And I want to read it real quick because I think this is where I, as a reader, really enjoy this style because I feel like it draws out action, but it still shows you every moment while being really literary. So it says, it was after sundown when they reached home. They ate supper by lamplight. Then sitting on the doorstep, the boy watched the night fully accomplished, listening to the whippoorwills and the frogs when he heard his mother's voice, Abner, no, no, oh God, Abner. And he rose, whirled, and saw the altered light through the door where a candle stub now burned in a bottleneck on the table, and his father still in the hat and coat, at once formal and burlesque, as though dressed carefully and for some shabby and ceremonial violence, emptying the reservoir of the lamp back into the 5-gallon kerosene can from which it had been filled, while the mother tugged at his arm until he shifted the lamp to the other hand and flung her back back, not savagely or viciously, just hard, into the wall, her hands flung out against the wall for balance, her mouth open, and in her face the same quality of hopeless despair as had been in her voice. Then his father saw him standing in the door. So that paragraph is three sentences, technically.
Oh, yeah.
There's something about when it kind of goes on. It feels like a run-on, and though we know it's not because it's expertly crafted, right?
Well, I mean, it is a run-on. A run-on is just a description. It doesn't mean it's a bad sentence.
It's not without grammar, and I think that's what people sometimes mistake run-ons for. They think this is technically a run-on.
Somebody just made up this, this rule that you can only have one conjunction in a sentence.
Yes.
And then they called any breaking of that rule a run-on. It's invented. It was made out of nothing. It's not a real thing. Anyway, that's my diatribe.
Yeah. I guess people, like when people use it, they I think there's a time and place to point out that you've written a long ass fucking sentence that doesn't end or conclude or has no grammar. Anyway, this is not one of those in the sense that you can follow it and every thought does conclude. And even when it stops to pause to tell you how the father flung the mother, you haven't lost the thread. We talk a lot, I feel like, in our workshop when people are doing action scenes, how sometimes depending on how you've described it, you have made one or two flicks of a knife, a 10-minute ordeal. You know what I mean? And there's
ordeal.
This
I like that.
You know what
description.
I mean, a lot of times action writing is horribly done because people want to describe it in painstaking detail, but it doesn't capture the essence of what it was like to be there. It's not done quickly. I love this because I think every detail here was important. I caught myself wondering if we needed to know about the candle, but obviously we do because we're talking about kerosene, right? But also describing the light at which the father is, you know, illuminated here. Like the quality of that light is important and all of these things, even the fact that like he flings the mother out of the way, we still need to know how she lands because it tells you like how violent this guy is and dismissive almost, right? He doesn't do it cruelly, but he also doesn't care. And he just throws her and tells the kid what to do. And then this is one of those scenes that, you know, makes what the kid does at the end believable.
Yeah, I wonder if we were to sit down and like describe the grammar of every clause in this sentence, like what that would look like.
Painful.
Like you said, there's three periods in this, right? The first two sentences are, or the first and the last sentences are very short. It was after sundown when they reached home. The last one is, then his father saw him standing in the door. And the middle one is this long. It starts off very simply. They ate supper, right? That could be its own sentence. But they ate supper by lamplight. Then, this is like the compound. Then, and this is like a adverbial, sitting on the doorstep. It's a participle, right?
Yeah.
The boy watched. That's like the second conjoined sentence. So after the conjunction, okay. The boy watched the night fully accomplish. And then another participle, listening to the whippoorwills and the frogs. When he heard his mother's, like the way that things are piled on is not breaking rules of grammar, if you will. It's breaking stylistic kind of like rules of rhetoric or clarity, maybe, where you don't want to pile on too many clauses because you lose a sense of what the core of the sentence is. If you just want to say, because in rhetoric, it's an exhortation. You're trying to like get your audience to come along with you. You're trying to be very clear and you're trying to do something to your audience. So if you want to impart information, you want to make sure the information is salient. But if you pile a bunch of clauses around it, then the information loses its salience, right? But in this, it's not about that. This is about showing us an experience, showing us like the movement of action within a room or within a scene. So each clause stands on its own as a moment within that action. They ate supper, sitting on the doorstep, boy watched the night, listening to the whippoorwills, heard his mother's voice, he rose, whirled, saw the altered light. Like all these things are just like moments. They can pile on each other because they build together. They don't have to be individual. They all work together.
Right.
And in series as well, because not only is the depiction serial, whereas like it's one thing that happens and another thing that happens, but it's also words themselves and sentences and clauses are always delivered linearly, like one item at a time. They work hand in hand in that way. So yeah, so I started that by saying it's, you know, I don't think you can ever say that it's breaking grammatical rules, because if you broke a grammatical rule, you would lose track of what's of anything,
yes.
Right? If the subject and the verb don't agree, then you don't know who's doing what, but Faulkner's not going to do that. It's breaking rhetorical stylistic rules that are geared towards something that is not what this is trying to do.
Yeah, like clarity, like you said.
Yeah, something, things like clarity or like singularity of purpose.
Conciseness. Yes, decision. Yes. Singularity of purpose. What was the point of this sentence? Oh, yes, the frogs. Okay, so we talked about having to get our bearings in the story, and I don't know about you, but I didn't necessarily know that this was a story about the boy's kind of change of heart, if that makes sense.
Like you didn't expect that that's what it was, where it was going to end, or.
Yeah, just because I wasn't, I guess we start with the dad facing consequences for burning barns, and then he does it again, and the kid's like, can't believe this. But we don't really know tons about what it was like growing up with this dad, at what point he realized that what he was doing was happening or that it was bad. I guess we're visiting the boy at a time where it feels extremely heightened, but I'm surprised that if this is your father and this is his behavior, that there haven't been a million other times where the behavior might have been directed at you personally that would have made you want to leave, kind of. I don't know. I was surprised that the kid left and surprised that that's kind of what I was reading toward, you know?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you got to pick a moment that is a story, right? That is representing that change. And he establishes the beginning as like the kid's about to lie for him. He's not asked to ultimately, but he's ready to, presumably. Although it's just questionable whether he would have. He knows he's supposed to. He never commits to it, but he doesn't have to. But that's like the world he's in. We know that. But then he kind of goes along for the rest of it until his dad grabs kerosene. And then he's like, oh shit, we got to do something here.
Yeah, he's like, he's gonna do it again. He's learned nothing.
But this key two paragraphs after where you stopped reading is like the key moment. He was moving, running outside the house toward the stable. This is the old habit, the old blood, which he had not been permitted to choose for himself, which had been bequeathed him willy-nilly, and which had run for so long and who knew where, battening on what of outrage and savagery and lust before it came to him. I could keep on, he thought. I could run on and on and never look back, never need to see his face again. Only I can't. I can't. The rusted can in his hand now, the liquid splashing. That's like right where you read is like right where the moment of crisis is about to happen, where he's making that decision.
I mean, not all stories need to be ones where you can like necessarily predict it, but I just wasn't even sure it was necessarily the kid's story.
Oh yeah, that's true. It seems like the father's story in a lot of ways. And in some ways it is, because he winds up dying at the end, right?
And
Maybe.
I guess we're just not necessarily, like, if you had to look at it with some rules in place or expectations in place, I mean, you could argue that it has to be the son's story because he's the only one that's going to be dynamic or has the ability to be dynamic. Like, the father is going to be, he's a stubborn character.
Yeah, he's stuck.
Yeah, he's not going to change. You can kind of predict that from the get-go. So maybe that's all the clue you kind of need to know that that's who you're paying attention to. But yeah, I was like, oh man, this kid just left. And I guess I also was left with the question, like, what does that mean for him? Does that mean he's going to be okay? You know what I mean? I'm
Well, who
like,
knows?
is he going to his friend's house? What's the plan here? He's running away. But I guess I had questions as to how serious that decision was. We're supposed to take it as like, this is definitive. He's leaving, probably for good. But I had questions about like, how is that possible for this kid?
There are moments in the story where it's like it mentions that he didn't know it now, but he would look back 20 years hence and realize something. And so you get a sense that he survives all this. He gets to remember it.
I guess it's just like until that point, I don't know maybe enough about the world or the time period to know that like a kid can do that successfully.
Something along those lines, I was thinking about after I reread it and I was almost done with it, I realized how Southern it is and how like post-Civil War South and how much it draws on that. I mean, it's Faulkner, and like I read the author's name and I know what I'm in for. And as far as that goes, I know that this is going to be set in the South. It's going to be Southern lit, right? It's going to deal with themes that are from a certain era and certain place. And it is, and it does. And I was thinking, could I read this without seeing the author's name, without knowing it's a Faulkner story? And how long would it take to get oriented in it if Faulkner's name was erased from the front page? It was just like, hey, read this story by some unknown author. And I'd be like, was this some guy from Japan? Let me check it out. And I don't know, because I didn't reread it after having that thought. But it is so ensconced in that world that once you realize where you are, it's very evocative. And if you know what you're looking at, you recognize it. But it's just a thought, like as far as like expectations as readers is like how much is required of us when we go in in there. Like you were talking about with like knowing whether it was the boy's story or the father's story. I mean, this story is only what, 18 pages? You can't put everything in it.
I'm trying to think what my takeaway would be from a story like this. And I know I've mentioned it before, but I had a fiction professor a long time ago who surprisingly was able to give us like very concrete lessons. You know, I feel like a lot of times you take classes and they're just kind of fostering your talents.
It's like, let's all sit in this room and be writers.
Which I think is like probably the best way to learn. But also, like I said, so it was surprising to get like concrete lessons. And one of them was like to just intentionally vary your sentence structure. And he would give us exact sentences to kind of copy. And then, you know, make sure that the next story you turned in had that. And there was something about forcing yourself to do it that made you want to keep doing it, but that also like immediately just like permanently put that tool in your toolkit. And I think if you've learned to write in a way that has these quote unquote run-ons, you know, or you've learned to write in the stream of consciousness way, maybe you don't remember the exact time and place where you learned to adopt it in a believable way. But for me, I can, and I remember because this professor showed us. And I think my takeaway would be when you read something like this, and you like it, and it is so different from what you are used to writing or able to write, one of the ways to learn how to do it is to intentionally do it. Just copy it. You cannot be Faulkner, hate to break to you, you know? So like no one will accuse you of that.
Yeah.
And it's only in intentionally copying this and intentionally trying these things that you develop your own style or learn to do what you're doing better, you know? So I really like the paragraph that I read just because I feel like it was, you know, visual. It wasn't trying to explain a character's thoughts and feelings and all these kind of things. It was the action on the page in the moment, kind of. And that might be an easy way to kind of enter, to kind of start. Maybe it's really hard for you to imagine stream of consciousness in a story where you're not constantly like in a character's head the way this is or the way other types of writing is, but maybe you have a scene that's action-packed and maybe you can write it in this kind of sweeping, prolonged way.
I think this story is probably a really good demonstration of how to move in and out of it.
Yeah, with dialogue usually.
He weaves in dialogue. Even the paragraph you read had two short sentences that bracketed it. So there are moments when it's
take a breath.
More effective, like taking a breath or just pulling out of the stream of consciousness, getting a lay of the land, different registers.
Yeah. And in that section, the sweeping part is the horror of what's happening, right? It's that his father bursts in the door. He's been listening to the frogs outside and the night is wrapping up and the sun is setting and everything's kind of quiet and it's him and his mom, but then he hears this commotion and his dad is there. And then his dad flings his mom and then he grabs the kerosene and he starts pouring it. And then it puts just such a fine point on that dialogue at the end there, when it does break up the sentence structure and it varies it, like it says, get the oil, you know, like it becomes so powerful. And then the last sentence, the last thing the dad says is go. And you know, based on everything that you've read and how, you know, jarring it was for the kid that he said go in the most definitive, booming kind of final tone that he could take on. And it, the juxtaposition is what really strengthens everything. And that was one of the things that I remember this fiction professor telling us, like when you have a sentence like that, but it does kind of drop in out of nowhere or a different kind of style, it puts a finer point on everything around it. The reader is forced to pay attention and it does a lot for the overall effect of your writing.
Yeah, there's a similar thing in what I read. One of the reasons I picked the section I read was because it ended on that little fight he had with the other kid.
Yeah.
That's in also, it's like a single sentence for the whole paragraph, but it ends with his father saying, get in the wagon.
Yeah, yeah.
I've heard this, I can't remember the exact context of what it was, but they talked about, it was like, I think it was an author who was talking about his writing process, and he actually will lay out like long paragraph, one sentence paragraph, long paragraph, long paragraph, one sentence paragraph. And like, this is what these three, this set of three needs to do so that it can end on the one sentence beat. And the beat has to do this thing, has to impart this emotion.
That makes so much sense. Yeah.
Like you can map out your prose that way. A lot of writers fall into that by feel. You can plan it. You can analyze prose and then figure out different ways of doing it to accomplish those beats in different moments. But if you want to build emotions in prose, like figuring out how to climb up to this moment of good emotion, of the emotion you want, you know, it's going to take work to get there. And then you have, when you got to hit it, when you hit, get to it, sometimes that's when you break your long sentence into a short one.
Yeah.
Or it could go the other way, like whatever works, but figuring out those beats at a prose level, that's a great takeaway. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have to do like the storyboarding that you're talking about for your entire book, but for the moments that you really want to count, that's such a brilliant idea to really think like, this is how I want this paragraph to end. This is how I want this chapter to feel when it's over. And how do I get there stylistically? Like you said, some people do it by feel, but I would argue that even the people that can do it pretty well naturally could benefit from doing it a little more intentionally.
Yeah.
And that sometimes that's editing, but sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's looking at how long your paragraphs are and all of that.
The by feel is sometimes like you're rereading, you're editing. And like you feel it, you feel the emotion, and you realize the last half of this long sentence kind of kills the emotion. So I'm going to lop it off. And just that first part is a short, punchy thing that captures the whole thing. And that works. And you've arrived at the same place by noticing that the long part of the sentence has ruined the effect. So noticing that will help you in the future. Just internalize that. Your feeling can be, oh, I feel a short sentence needs to be here. And so you're still feeling your way through it, but you have that tool of short sentence. Works. Long sentence for this part, short sentence for this part. Because as you're going through the prose, you're feeling each moment kind of build up.
Is that kind of your takeaway then, like the storyboarding of it, or did you have something different you wanted to
No,
point out?
I just thought of that one because of what you're saying. But my takeaway is kind of a repeat. I don't remember exactly what my takeaway was for the last episode, but I knew it was my takeaway when I picked this story was going to be something along the lines of how voice can reflect character situation. Like we talked about in the last episode about because the character was paying so close attention to little details, it kind of lent itself to this kind of painstaking, what I called it, fussy kind of style. The same thing can be said for this because it's the character, the boy's like what the boy's going through, how he's reacting to his father, and these like the stream of consciousness moments are there as reactions to and like kind of like they're built around the father and how he's interacting with the father. His stream of consciousness because he's not reflective, right? He's like reacting. And so like those kinds of things can inform a prose style or a voice for a story. And in addition, like I said, when I finished reading this out loud, I was like, it felt wrong to not read it with a southern accent. Like those kinds of things also, like the place that they're from, you know, the culture they're from can also inform voices. Which if you want to talk about culture informing a voice, that's Faulkner. That's like encyclopedia entry about voice. I don't have more to say to that because I feel like the work to do like anything very specific would be really painstaking. Like I said, like diagramming sentences or pulling apart sentences to find those like how they're piled onto each other. And each moment's going to be done slightly differently because of the way the story evolves and the voice evolves with it. But also, like we were just talking about with your takeaway, varying the sentences, the structure of the sentences in order to accomplish, because the voice should change from beginning to end too in certain ways. I said in the last episode that I didn't think authors should have voices. I thought stories should have voices, but I think of stories' voice can change as it's going because the mood changes, like a story's mood changes. So you can start a story with a really like kind of loose, open voice, but then by the time you get to the end of it, it's like constrained because it's more emotional or more reserved or something.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So all those things should influence the momentary voice of and style of the prose you're writing.
All right, thanks, guys. If you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. And for industry news, writing tips, and great short fiction, join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/NaplesWritersWorkshop. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at napleswritersworkshop.com.